from KQED.
We're now going to shift gears to the novel coronavirus. The U.S. death toll from the virus has risen to 6, and global deaths have surpassed 3,000. And meanwhile, as the Trump administration has come under fire for producing faulty test kits, Vice President Pence said in a recent press briefing yesterday that the risk to Americans remains low and that a vaccine could be going to clinical trials within 6 weeks. We're going to talk about the latest coronavirus developments first with KQED News reporter Peter Arcuni, who's here with us in studio. Peter, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there have been a lot of concerns and questions about testing or the lack thereof. You've been reporting. What have you found?
So last week, Governor Newsom said that the state only had 200 working test kits and that was just not going to be enough, and that the CDC had assured him that many, many more kits were on the way. We do have word that that has happened. The state is now saying they received those kits and they have the capacity to test, they're saying, thousands of specimens for the novel coronavirus.
There's also been hearing this term, presumptive positive. Remind us, what is that?
Right. So presumptive positive is what is how the state announces their positive tests. And that's standard operating procedure for any new test developed by the CDC. So the CDC developed the test. It was approved by the FDA. Now the states have it. But while they're getting their labs up and running, they might get a positive test, but they also send the sample to the CDC to see if they get the same result. Now, after a certain period of time, once the CDC is confident that all the labs are getting the same result as them, then they'll say that the labs, the local labs can go ahead and say positive. In the meantime, local and state health officials assure me that if they do get a presumptive positive, they will proceed as if the patient is positive for the novel coronavirus and take all precautions and treat that patient.
What's next in your reporting with respect to going to look into with respect to testing?
Well, I think it's just important, you know, it's what Gavin Newsom said last week, that point of contact local testing is really important, and it's important for a couple of different reasons. One, you get those test results back sooner, right? So you can get the test results in 48 hours as opposed to waiting, you know, up to a week, they were saying, once you had to send the kits to Atlanta or, you know, to the CDC and then get the results. So not only can you get the results faster, but it's important that all the labs and, and even local hospitals have these kits because then they can start being more inclusive with the testing criteria, right? So if you have only a limited number of kits, you have to prioritize who you're going to test. And so far, that's been only the people that are deemed very, very, very high risk. So now with more testing kits, and once the counties and the local hospitals actually get those kits, they can be more inclusive and test people that may have, you know, some symptoms but don't check all the boxes. Test those folks sooner, get them into isolation, get them treated and away from the general population.
Peter, good to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's Peter Arcuni, reporter for KQED News, and thank you for the good work you've done. And I'm going to give out the number now because I know there are many of you with questions about coronavirus. And if you do have a question, please give us a call. You can do that now. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, and that's toll-free again, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have to forum@kqed.org. And we're going to be joined now by Edith Bracco Sanchez, who's a pediatrician at Columbia University, and we welcome you to the program, Dr. Bracco Sanchez. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Michael. Nice being with you guys.
Good to have you. As I said, and let's talk first about testing. Where are we? We've been getting sort of contradictory information, and help us sort through it.
Yes. So we are behind when it comes to testing. I think there's no question that we are behind, and we're learning more and more details as to why that happened. I'm willing and eager and waiting for the specifics of why the CDC decided to deviate from the testing that the WHO had been conducting and conduct and develop their own testing that, as we know at this point, was faulty. As of yesterday, the announcement that the FDA commissioner made is that we're going to have an additional 1 million tests distributed around the country. I'm very curious to see whether that actually happens. And I think all of us on the ground are hoping that this does happen and that it works.
It must be frustrating, particularly to someone in your position, because, well, for example, Vice President Pence said there's very little risk to Americans. It's a low risk. The president said a vaccine is on the way. And we have somebody like the eminent Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is head of infectious diseases, who has been saying over and over again, these are just not facts. These are false news.
That's exactly right, Michael. And I think we are starting to hear from our patients on the ground, you know, when is the treatment for this coronavirus coming? Should I get tested? When's the vaccine coming? And we have to, because of that mixed messaging, we have to emphasize to our own patients, listen, this vaccine's not coming for at least a year, and explain why that is. And that's because it needs to go through all the safety testing. And we need to make sure that it works. It takes time when you're testing a vaccine to actually make sure that it works.
Talking again with Dr. Edith Bracho-Sanchez, a pediatrician at Columbia University. We're going to go to your calls here in a moment, but could you say something about travel? I mean, again, we're getting a lot of misinformation and disinformation and contrary information. What's the best advice you can provide at this point?
I think at this point, if you can postpone any non-essential international travel, I would. And I say this because we have travel restrictions that are being implemented, and it changes day by day. The best place to go for that information is the CDC, the CDC's website. But at the same time, we only see those restrictions being put in place after a significant outbreak develops in a particular part of the world. And I have to tell you, Michael, I've been, you know, sitting at home in the evenings wondering, okay, but what about right before? So I just, you know, any non-essential international travel that we can postpone at this point, I personally am saying to my patients, go ahead and do that.
Can I also ask you, Dr. Bracho-Sanchez, about children, particularly are they carriers? Because I know that, you know, it's been said over and over again that they're less likely to get the coronavirus, but to what extent are they really vulnerable? And also about pregnant women.
Right. And the answer, Michael, to be completely transparent, is that we don't know to what extent children are carrying this virus, and we don't know to what extent it affects and how severe this illness is in pregnant women. The initial data that we have is coming out of China. Not very many children were tested, and also not a lot of pregnant women in the samples, in the studies that have come out in the New England Journal and The Lancet. So I think we're looking for now what it looks like is that children are not as affected as adults. But I think any pediatrician will tell you there's no question that the likelihood that they're carrying this disease is high.
You mentioned data out of China. I mean, certainly we had a very strong difficulty and challenge getting data out of China initially. But at this point, what about drugs? Because a lot of the ingredients for drugs are coming out of China.
Right. And I think that's been the concern of a lot of public health experts. You know, how are we addressing the fact that we may have some shortages in those ingredients and that Americans may be affected by this? They may see their prescription drugs become unavailable. And so far, Michael, to be honest, I have not seen a response from our government in terms of, you know, what are we doing to address that those ingredients are still available?
Edith Bracho-Sanchez with us, pediatrician at Columbia University. And we go to Mary as our first caller. Mary, you're on the air. Good morning.
Oh, hi. My quick question is to federal and local government, I mean, all level, the state, the county, and the city, and mostly to CDC, mainly to CDC. It's been 5 weeks since the outbreak in China. People are watching, and why over 5-6 weeks the test kits are still in such a shortage?
Why the delay, I think, is really what you're asking, Mary, and I thank you for that question. Dr. Bracho-Sanchez?
Yeah, I think that's a great question as well. And I think the reason is they attempted to create their own testing kits. I don't fully understand the logistics as to why that was, what the reasoning was behind that. I think we're going to learn more in the weeks to come. So I don't think this was a purposeful decision to delay the testing. I think it was a thoughtful decision probably at the moment, giving everyone the benefit of the doubt. But there's no question that we are now behind, and the administration has said that by the end of the week, this problem will be corrected.
Let me thank Mary for her call. I want to get right to another caller here, and that's Taryn joining us from Danville. Taryn, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, hi, good morning. I just have a comment. It's more in terms of more efficient ways of testing. Right now, the testing is putting a lot of strain on the resources, including the professionals and the facilities. I just wanted to see if your guests had any thoughts about, you know, the more efficient ways of testing, kind of like, you know, drive-by testing that South Korea is doing, you know, so that not every patient needs to come to the hospital for testing and not every patient needs to be admitted to the hospital. So I can take my answer off air, but I just wanted to kind of focus on more effective and efficient ways of testing rather than putting a strain on our resources.
Yeah, that's an excellent question as well. We're always sort of balancing, I think right now in particular, we're balancing the need to do surveillance testing. So you're absolutely right that not everyone who has this virus needs to come to the hospital or needs to be hospitalized. On the contrary, what we know is that 80% of people with this virus end up having a mild illness. So I agree with you, not everyone needs to come in, but the need right now is to do surveillance testing if we are hoping to contain this virus or limit its spread. And in terms of the drive-by testing or the rapid test, right, like we have rapid tests that we do for flu, I am very much looking to see if we can develop those types of tests, and I hope that we get creative here.
There's new news, and I'd like your response, if you could, Dr. Bracho-Sanchez. COVID-19 fatality rate is now, according to the World Health Organization, up to 3.4%. The head of the WHO is now saying about 3.4% of infected with the new coronavirus have died. That's much higher than the fatality rate for seasonal flu.
That is much, much higher. I'd say about 30 times as high, just doing the quick math. But I think the important thing to continue to emphasize is that we are going to see fluctuations in this number, and I can't stress that enough. This is a provisional number. Earlier we had heard 2%, now we're hearing 3%. I don't think we're going to know until we have done all of the testing and really account for the people who have mild to no symptoms at all. Until those people are counted, we just don't know.
Again, we're talking to Dr. Edith Bracho-Sanchez. She's a pediatrician at Columbia University and assistant professor of pediatrics at the Columbia University Irving Medical Center. Could I get you to say something about what we've learned from past problems we've had along these lines? I was thinking this morning about H1N1, the swine flu back in 2009. It was the last time we had a pandemic on U.S. soil. And, I mean, it wasn't nearly as virulent or anything as contagious as what we're seeing now. But I'm wondering what we learned from that. And frankly, what did we learn from HIV back in the 1980s?
Yes. Oh, my gosh. We have learned a lot. Clearly not enough, but we did learn a lot. I think a lot of our planning right now, I can tell you, physicians on the ground are preparing for the disease itself to spread, but we're also preparing for fear and concern to spread. I think anyone who practices can probably relate to this. We end up getting a lot of visits for concern for the virus. Very, very mild symptoms, but people hear so much about it that they want to be seen, they want to be checked. And so we're preparing for both things right now.
But excuse me, we don't have the infrastructure really, do we?
We don't. We don't. And we're getting very creative. And, you know, part of my position here at Columbia involves directing telehealth, telemedicine efforts. And so we're starting to ask ourselves the question, I can't speak for anything being in place yet, and I'm not an official spokesperson for a hospital, but we're starting to ask ourselves the questions, how do we think creatively about this so that we reassure the people that need to be reassured and give care to the people that need the urgent care? And very quickly, I think the other thing that we have learned is that stigma can be incredibly dangerous when it comes to this. And so I cannot emphasize enough, this is a virus that affects humans, also animals, as we saw, but it is a virus that affects humans. All of us, right, are at risk. And so the stigma is not going to help us if we're going to contain this.
Let me bring some more callers on, and we go next to a caller named David. David, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Great segment. My question is, different viruses have different timelines for survival outside of a host, and I'm wondering how long this COVID-19 survives, because I've heard several hours to 9 days.
Yeah, we've been talking about this previous programs. Can you outline the incubation and the survival of the virus for us, Dr. Bracho-Sanchez?
Sure. So the incubation is anywhere from a couple of days up to 14 days, which is why the quarantines have been implemented for 14 days. And when it comes to the time that the virus survives outside of a host, in this case, outside of a human, I have read the same data that your caller, David, has read, 2 hours to 9 days. And I think, you know, we're going to learn more about this virus. Again, we're still very early. The one thing that reassures me is that this is, you know, just to talk a little bit about basic biology, this is an enveloped virus. And when you think about the envelopes of viruses and the viruses that have an envelope, they're very delicate. They actually do require a certain level of moisture, certain level of host in a way to survive. And so I'm a little optimistic knowing the basic characteristics of this virus, but we just don't have that data yet.
A listener named Tracy wants to know, why can't testing developers create much more efficient tests? Strep testing is now cheap and efficient and done in doctors' offices. What do test companies, did the test companies make money from lab work?
Interesting question. So it takes time. I mean, truthfully, I think we will see the race to develop quicker, more accurate tests at a lower price. We need it. The world needs it. I think pharmaceuticals are coming together and laboratories are coming together to create and develop those tests. It just takes time, right? Like the virus had to be isolated, then it had to be sequenced, then we had to create something that was reliable. And then after that, you start talking about faster, cheaper.
The World Health Organization is also saying, Dr. Bracho Sanchez, that protective gear such as masks and goggles for health workers are running out. Some thoughts from you on that?
I'm very concerned about this, Michael, to be honest.
We
need those. And you know, I think the general public understandably feels like they need to put something on, anything to protect themselves. But I just want you to pause and think about us, the healthcare workers on the front line, who are no doubt going to come into contact with this virus. And we just need it in order to protect ourselves and to keep caring for people who have this. So I'm seeing the production increase, but I'm also I also would like people to be mindful about that.
Quick question from a listener named Wallace. Could this virus have been around? He wants to know a lot longer. I have a family and friends in the medical profession. They tell me that a lot of flu-like patients tested negative for flu but had all the symptoms and flu hit very hard this season.
It's possible, Michael, and I think we're learning from the community spread in other states that it's very possible. And when we compare the genetic sequences from initial viruses, COVID-19, to later diagnosis, a month later, they're related. So this is very possible. I think we're going to know more as soon as we start doing this widespread testing.
We will leave it there and hope the widespread testing will be brought to fruition. Dr. Bracho Sanchez, so good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's Edith Bracho Sanchez. She's a pediatrician and Columbia Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at Columbia's Irving Medical Center. Another hour forum up ahead. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.